I'm David Remnick, and each week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, my colleagues and I unpack what's happening in a very complicated world. You'll hear from the New Yorker's award-winning reporters and thinkers, Jelani Cobb on race and justice, Jill Lepore on American history, Vincent Cunningham and Gia Tolentino on culture, Bill McKibben on climate change, and many more. To get the context behind events in the news, listen to the New Yorker Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
The world's changing climate makes tropical storms more dangerous. In Bangladesh, they've gotten good at giving people an early warning, which is saving lives.
You can have the best predictions, but if you're not able to communicate that information to the people who need it, then your early warning system will not be as effective.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. The climate science around hurricanes. In Washington, there's bipartisan agreement about the China threat, but some say U.S. policy could be smarter.
Have we actually been able to change China's behavior in any way? No.
We'll also hear about a museum here in the U.S. that's revisiting how it depicts local history.
So if you came here and you looked around before any of this, you would not necessarily see yourself.
All those stories and more today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. We kick things off today with a weather report.
Right now at noon, Helene, now a hurricane.
We want to bring you the latest on this storm. And
all right, talking about what to anticipate.
Boy. We always say, hide from the wind, run from the water.
Potentially life-threatening levels of both are bearing down on the southeastern U.S. this week.
Hurricane Helene formed this week in the Caribbean, with winds expected to hit 125 miles an hour as it heads across the Gulf of Mexico. Floridians are being urged to evacuate coastal areas. Resident Natalia Serra is getting ready.
So I'm a little scared right now. But at least we're going to be more prepared, you know? We're going to move everything, pick up everything, try to cover the entrance.
It's just the latest storm to hit the area this season. Robin and Spencer Palmer are also preparing.
Actually, I'm okay. I wasn't at first. All I did was cry. But at this point, it is what it is. You can't change it.
We didn't prep at all because we didn't think anything was going to happen. And now we're over-prepping, hopefully, so nothing will happen. That's the goal.
Storm prep is familiar for people in regions prone to hurricanes, typhoons, and cyclones. Whatever name you use for these storms, climate change appears to be making them stronger and intensify more quickly. A few of the worst storms over the last year barreled into Mexico, China, and Myanmar, killing hundreds of people.
Researchers are trying to understand exactly how a warming world is driving these changes so they can better understand what the future holds. Here's science reporter Ari Daniel.
How do you study a hurricane anytime you want? You make one. Eric Selna steps inside a building resembling an airplane hangar west of Miami. Two rows of six giant yellow fans tower above him and his hard hat. This is the wall of wind. Or wow.
The wall of wind is able to replicate a hurricane. We can go up to Category 5 hurricane force winds.
Selna is a meteorologist at the Extreme Events Institute, which is housed at Florida International University. He walks around to the other side of the fan wall.
We have our water nozzles on there. We can add water into the system to replicate 8 to 9 inches of rainfall per hour.
Researchers place scaled building models downwind of all that fury to see how different structures hold up and how we can fortify our built environment.
So roof design and shape, walls, windows, doors, roofing components, shingles, tiles.
Plus traffic signals, cell towers, and solar panels.
So all of that related to how can we make our homes and businesses stronger.
It's an impressive laboratory. There's just one problem. Its maximum wind speed of 157 miles per hour isn't enough anymore, since hurricanes have gotten more powerful. According to the National Hurricane Center, in 2017, Irma achieved 178 mile per hour maximum winds. 2 years later, Dorian got up to 184. And so the National Science Foundation is sponsoring a new facility that'll generate wind speeds up to 200 miles per hour. A massive water tank will simulate storm surge.
The whole goal is to build a larger structure, a stronger structure, get more hazards under one roof. It's an opportunity to keep up and to be proactive rather than reactive to what's happening with Mother Nature.
Mother Nature with a boost from humans because hurricanes seem to be strengthening due to a changing climate.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's pretty significant concern that hurricanes, they are likely to be more impactful and cause more damage.
Dan Chavas is an atmospheric scientist at Purdue University, and he says to understand what's going on, it helps to know that the ocean and atmosphere are linked. A hurricane offers a vivid demonstration. It's fueled by warm water evaporating off the ocean's surface.
And it's able to turn that into energy to power the winds of the hurricane itself.
That is, hurricanes convert heat from the ocean into ferocious winds.
At least at a basic level, warmer water can provide more fuel for hurricanes.
So as the world warms and sea surface temperatures climb, that's leading to stronger hurricanes, slower hurricanes in some places, and wetter hurricanes.
Warmer air can hold more water. You have a storm that stops moving, especially if it's along the coast. It's just sitting and dumping and dumping and dumping rain.
It adds up to a punishing combination, one that may well be more dangerous, and as if that weren't enough.
Can you see my screen?
Karthik Balaguru is a climate scientist at the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory, and he's showing me images of Hurricane Otis from last year.
And this is the track of the storm.
It began as a tropical storm in the eastern Pacific, several hundred miles off the coast of southern Mexico. A day before it made landfall, forecasters predicted it would stay a tropical storm or maybe become a Category 1 hurricane.
It's not the stuff of nightmares, but the storm exploded in intensity just a day before landfall and became a Category 5 hurricane, and it completely decimated Acapulco.
All communications went down for days. There were at least 52 dead, another 32 missing. Otis was the costliest storm in Mexican history. And unfortunately, that hurricane wasn't unique.
If you look at the global tropics and subtropics, what we found is that in coastal regions all over the world, there is a clear shift.
That more and more storms are intensifying faster just before they make landfall, which means that once a community knows how strong a storm or hurricane actually is, it may well be too late to prepare properly. Balaguru's computer simulations suggest the trend is likely to continue.
They also suggest that the ability of storms to intensify is likely going to increase. These sometimes make you a little bit uneasy. I mean, I don't want to sound like an alarmist, but there are these results that you can't ignore.
With observations and models all pointing the same way, earlier this year, researchers proposed adding a new category to the hurricane scale, Category 6. The recommendation hasn't been adopted yet. For The World, I'm Ari Daniel.
Knowing that storms will get worse is one thing. Preparing for that is another. It is possible to protect people from storms, even in places with limited resources. In Bangladesh, for example, violent cyclones kill relatively few people. That's thanks to a homegrown warning system. As The World's Patrick Wynn reports, Bangladesh seems to be making big strides in preventing storm deaths.
When the wind bends trees sideways and the sky turns the color of lead, most people hunker down. Not Mena's Titi. She hops on a motorbike and heads towards the storm. That's Titi, 29 years old, speeding down a skinny lane in May during the last big storm. She was gripping a siren in her free hand. Titi is from Shyamnagar, a flat expanse of rice paddies and shrimp farms fronting the Indian Ocean. There are lots of houses made of bamboo, with roofs made of tin sheeting. In hard winds, those roofs can get ripped off and fly away like a kite. Titi warns people, especially folks without TVs and cell phones, it's time to flee to a local shelter made of concrete.
এবং সংকেত অনুযায়ী সাইরেন বাজিয়ে প্লাস রাস্তা দিয়ে মাইকিং করতে করতে যাই এবং
First we warn people with our sirens, she says. When that doesn't work, we have to go door to door.
এটা প্রত্যেকটা ঝড়ের ক্ষেত্রে আমাদের এই মোমেন্টটা ফেস করতে হয়.
She says every single storm, I'll have to plead with people to leave their homes. Titi is one of 80,000 volunteers under the Bangladeshi government's Cyclone Preparedness Program. an innovative warning system. Ahamadul Haq is its director. He says it works because people like Titi know their villages inside and out.
They know the people. They know the risk, who and which family are most at risk.
They know who's too old to walk, who's pregnant, who's stubborn as heck and tries to stick out every cyclone. Volunteers don't get a dime for risking their lives to save others. Yet Haq says he doesn't have trouble recruiting. The trauma of past cyclones animates people, he says, makes them want to help. The program started in 1972, just a couple years after a cyclone called Bola ravaged Bangladesh.
The damage was colossal. That deadly cyclone caused the highest number of casualties in history.
He means all of recorded history. That cyclone killed roughly 500,000 people. Bangladesh is a crowded nation. Imagine half the U.S. population squeezed into an area the size of Illinois. Many people can't afford cement homes. So for decades, cyclones would knock down their walls, drowning people in their bedrooms. But over the decades, Bangladeshis perfected their own community-based warning system. By 1991, when another nasty cyclone hit, 140,000 people died. A tragedy, but evidence the system was improving. Now, fast forward to last year. A super cyclone, one of the strongest ever recorded off Bangladesh's coast, hit hard. Social media videos show winds shredding the leaves off trees as mosques broadcast calls to prayer. And this time, not a single Bangladeshi died. The reason Bangladesh has been so successful is it marries its intricate but low-tech warning system with data from the world's most powerful supercomputers.
The most advanced computing systems currently are not in the defense ministries. They're actually part of the meteorological offices.
John Harding heads an office on early warning systems at the World Meteorological Organization, a UN agency. He says the UN encourages countries such as Japan, the US, and India, which have weather-predicting supercomputers, to share data with countries such as Bangladesh. Bangladesh, he says, is a trailblazer in building a human network steeped in local knowledge to act on that data and roust people from their homes, millions of people if necessary.
You can have the best predictions, but if you're not able to communicate that information to the people who need it, then your early warning system will not be as effective.
One-third of all people on Earth aren't covered by any warning system at all. Harding says the Bangladesh model is a good one to imitate as storms around the world grow more and more fierce.
We've drawn extensively on the Bangladesh example in order to build up capacities in other countries. There's no questions about it.
No matter the country, the goal is to move people from flimsy housing to a shelter, a school, office building, any building made of cement. In Bangladesh, most families will hear a siren or see a warning on their phone and evacuate on their own. But some people need coercing or help. Bangladesh has learned that to save everyone, you need women on the rescue team. Menaz Titi says she'll go into homes where women, sometimes pregnant, won't let men touch them, even a rescue worker trying to carry them through floodwaters. Bangladesh is a conservative place. Titi says some women are very reluctant to go to a crowded shelter full of unfamiliar men. Back in the 70s in Bangladesh, cyclones killed 14 times more women than men. Haq, the program director, says by recruiting more women volunteers like Titi, Bangladesh has erased the gender gap in storm fatalities.
We proudly can say now it is balanced, 1:1.
Inside shelters, volunteers create three sections, one for men, one for women, one for the elderly. Menaz Titi and other women will stand guard. She says, if I promise women they'll be safe, I've got to deliver on my word.
Dangerous, but enjoyable.
It's dangerous work, but she enjoys it. Cyclone season has already come to Bangladesh and will run through the end of the year. Titi is a fashion designer, but she's between jobs now. So she's ready to leap into action when the next storm hits. Titi says her husband will say, can you please just stay away from the really risky areas? She'll reply, okay, dear, and go there anyway. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok.
We have been reporting lately on the climate change drivers of natural disasters and what we can do about them. Read more at theworld.org.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. For the first time in decades, public health data shows a drop in drug overdose deaths across the U.S. On the flip side of that hopeful news, a new synthetic opioid is showing up in North America, Europe, and Australia. It's called nitazene. Here in the U.S., we say nitazene. And it's even more powerful than fentanyl. Caroline Copeland directs the U.K.'s National Program on Substance Abuse Deaths. She says nitazenes have been around a while, but were never released to the public.
They were actually developed around about the same time as fentanyl. They were investigated to see if they could be used clinically. But it was decided that because they are so potent, they just weren't safe for human use. And so they were discontinued. And this is in the late 50s, early 60s. So they're quite an old class of drugs, but they are now just newly emerging on the unregulated drug market.
When did nitazene start showing up in the global drug trade?
So the first reports of a death in the UK that we have happened in 2019. That was around about the same time that there were some reports that they were showing up in drug supplies in Eastern Europe, so sort of Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia. That death in 2019 in the UK was actually an atypical death in comparison to the ones that we're seeing now. That was in a person who was a self-described explorer of the mind. And they ordered isotretinoin on the dark web and tried some. But isotretinoin is so potent that the amount of a grain of sand, a speck of dust, is enough to cause overdose. So in trying that, they fatally overdosed and died. But the majority of deaths that we're seeing, or almost exclusively the deaths that we're seeing now in the UK, are from people who don't realise that they're taking these compounds. They think that they're buying heroin or Valium or diazepam or oxycodone. And what they're actually getting mixed into these supplies is one of these nitazenes.
So what countries, Caroline, are seeing the worst impact from nitazene?
As far as I'm aware, it's the UK at the moment that is seeing the largest occurrence of deaths related to nitazene use. I have heard reports, though, just this past week, that a batch of counterfeit oxycodone tablets in the Netherlands was found to contain one of the nitazenes. And so it certainly looks like it is starting to spread over a wider proportion of Europe.
And I was reading that many police departments do not have testing kits for nitazene, so it's possible the real impact is not yet fully known?
Exactly. So you need to be able to have access to sensitive testing, and that's just not within the capabilities of a lot of police departments. And even in death, so post-mortem toxicology, if a standard drug screen is done and sufficient quantities of heroin or fentanyl or diazepam are found in a person's blood to have caused death, that's going to reduce the impetus to request a nitazene-specific screen to be done, because if you've already found enough drugs to have caused death, why go looking for more? So I think that the number of deaths that are happening are being widely underestimated. And I imagine as well the amount of drugs entering the country that contain this also, because the testing is just not being as routinely done.
So it was the drug marketing cartels that pushed nitazenes into the world again. What was the interest for them?
So we don't know this for sure, but in the UK, we think it is to do with the Taliban re-entering power in 2021. The UK and most of Western Europe get their heroin from Afghanistan. There was concerns that there was going to be a reduction in the amount of heroin coming out of Afghanistan when the Taliban re-entered control in 2021. One of their pledges was to stop the cultivation of the opium poppy. And so the organized crime gangs in Europe have gone, well, if we're not going to have our reliable source of heroin, what else can we use? And that's where the nitazenes have therefore come from. They are easy to manufacture, they're fairly cheap to manufacture, and they're easy to smuggle into the UK. They're so potent that you can get thousands of doses in a tiny sachet in a greetings card.
Caroline Copeland directs the UK's National Programme on Substance Abuse Deaths. She's also a lecturer at King's College London.
Sometimes it takes a while to see what is right in front of you, even if you happen to run a museum that celebrates local history. Take the Revere Historical Society near Boston. It recently closed its doors for major renovations. It also set out to rethink its core mission. GBH's James Bennett II reports from Revere, Massachusetts.
This is a story that starts with dolls. Handmade Moroccan dolls, to be precise.
This one is a bride. And this guy back here with the colorful headdress is a water bearer at a festival.
That's Brendan O'Brien. He helps run the museum. I've come here because I heard there was a room dedicated to Revere's immigrant communities. We were looking at these dolls, common Barbies or figurines. Their packaged clothing has been replaced with finely detailed traditional costume.
That guy back there is a Star Wars character that I recognize.
Wait, what?
Yep. So the Rebels cartoon, that's Kanan Jarrus. So they just took the dolls and took off whatever.
The dozen or so dolls were loaned to the museum. They sit in a glass case in a room on the first floor. For the past 2 years, the museum, it's been under extensive renovation. At the moment, there's clear plastic covering the old red carpet. Tarp is protecting the museum's precious items from dust. And the building is getting some upgrades. Plumbing, carpentry work, a new climate control system will keep the artifacts safe. While it was out of commission, museum staff started to reassess its own mission. Toby Perlstein runs the museum's operations. She says locals have told the museum they'd like to see more of themselves reflected in the space.
So if you came here and you looked around before any of this, you would not necessarily see yourself.
So, after they got those Moroccan dolls, they had an idea. The museum would dedicate a room to Revere's immigrant communities, but they needed stuff to make it happen. So, they put out a call for donations, and it worked. They got gorgeous gilded eggshell paintings from Chinese traditions and Brazilian football paraphernalia. There's a tower of Bosnian artifacts. Those came from a local woman who had lived through the Bosnian War. And Brendan O'Brien has a particular memory about that.
She brought a whole crew with her. They took over the kitchen. They made these incredible snacks. And they made Bosnian coffee, which will make you feel like you could run through a wall. It's just the most strongest coffee I've ever had. But she very graciously donated these things here.
The museum on Beach Street has 3 floors and about a dozen rooms. It covers a wide range of history, like the Revolutionary War, the days when Revere Beach was an amusement park, and its rich farming history. Revere has a city historian. His name is Jeff Perlman. And in his opinion, a room like this is imperative, given the paths of immigration into and out of Revere.
There were many Cambodians and Laotians that moved in the 70s and 80s especially, and many Hispanics also and Latinos moved in the late 20th and 21st century.
These days, many organizations and institutions are leaning into diversity, inclusion, questions about how representation matters. But to the locals who will soon stroll through the museum, they'll essentially be seeing themselves celebrated. For the world, I'm James Bennett II, Revere, Massachusetts.
Iran's new president spoke at UN headquarters this week. He blamed Israel for the escalating conflict in the Mideast, but he's also offering to revive nuclear talks.
Pezeshkian is trying to open negotiations with European countries that have been a party to the deal, but also particularly with the United States.
What's behind Iran's latest offer? That's ahead here on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. In the run-up to the November election in the U.S., neither of the two major party candidates is putting foreign policy at the center of their campaign platforms, except that both Kamala Harris and Donald Trump seem to be going out of their way to paint each other as being soft on China. That's because there's a lot of agreement in Washington across both parties about the U.S.-China rivalry. But as The World's Matthew Bell reports, there are significant differences in how Harris or Trump might shape U.S. policy, and Beijing is watching closely.
There's a widely accepted bipartisan consensus on China.
It took hold during the Trump administration, and it basically says that the United States and China are locked in a great power competition economically, politically, and militarily. From Beijing's perspective, this boils down to one thing, says Yu Jia, who's with the London-based think tank Chatham House. It's all about containing China.
To slow down China's growth prospects, but also to slow down China's process of acquiring power and influence internationally.
Yu says that China's leaders, including Xi Jinping, have reached their own conclusions about this great power rivalry.
The party elites firmly believe that the competition with the United States will be protracted, and it's really, for the case of China, they should mobilizing all kind of resources available in their hands in order to prepare the worst yet to come.
Yu says policy decisions on both sides are not made in a vacuum, and the current dynamic could push U.S.-China relations into a vicious downward spiral. China's state-run news agencies are keeping mostly quiet about the U.S. presidential race, but who would Chinese leaders prefer to see in the White House next January?
In my personal opinion, there is not a question. They want Donald Trump to win.
Joshua Eisenman is a China expert at the University of Notre Dame.
Their system is predicated on the fact that it is better than liberal democracy. And nothing would harm liberal democracy more than a Donald Trump presidency, which throws into question the U.S. system in general.
Then there's the perception of Trump's willingness to make a deal and not get hung up on ideology or long-standing U.S. policy in Asia. That might also be attractive to Beijing.
In this interview, he kind of came off as a bit, lukewarm on the idea of continuing to protect Taiwan, saying...
In July, Trump spoke to Bloomberg Businessweek and suggested that U.S. support for Taiwan, which China sees as a renegade province, may be negotiable. And here's the Republican Party candidate speaking at a recent campaign event in Flint, Michigan.
I always say if you have a smart president, you'll never have a problem with China, Russia, or any of them, okay? I got along great with Putin. I got along great with President Xi. I got along great with Kim Jong-un of North Korea.
Trump's affinity for authoritarian leaders aside, Beijing will not soon forget what happened during Trump's 4 years in power. The American president turned up the anti-China rhetoric. He brought some hardline China hawks into his administration. And Trump kicked off a trade war, says Dali Yang of the University of Chicago.
China had a really bitter experience with Trump, with the trade war. Again, it's that element of unpredictability of Trump that matters for the Chinese. The Chinese economy faces major headwinds as well.
For these reasons, Yang reckons that Beijing probably has a slight preference for Kamala Harris, even if she too talks about standing up to the People's Republic. During the debate, Harris accused Trump of selling out to China.
Policy about China should be in making sure the United States of America wins the competition for the 21st century, which means focusing on the details of what that requires, focusing on relationships with our allies, focusing on investing in American-based technology.
Harris has not talked a lot about how she would win the competition with Beijing. Experts say a Harris administration, if she's elected, would probably adopt a China policy that's very similar to President Joe Biden's. He has kept the Trump-era tariffs in place. He's promised to protect Taiwan from Chinese aggression. But Biden has also gone out of his way to open up lines of communication with Beijing. Susan Shirk with the 21st Century China Center at UC San Diego says there's still an opportunity here for the next U.S. administration to move beyond the so-called bipartisan consensus that strictly views China as a threat.
What have we achieved in the last 8 years? Have we actually been able to change China's behavior in any way? Is it reduced its human rights abuses in Xinjiang or Hong Kong or the rest of China? No.
Shirk wrote a book called Overreach, How China Derailed Its Peaceful Rise. By overreach, she's referring to things like China threatening its neighbors in Asia, from Australia to Japan to Taiwan.
I believe that America has overreacted to that overreach in a way which is harming our own economy, our society, and we've diminished the openness, which is the comparative advantage of the United States.
10 or 15 years ago, public opinion polls in the U.S. gave China a favorable rating of about 50%. The most recent Pew Research Center survey shows China with an unfavorable view of more than 80%. But there's much less to this consensus on China than it might appear, according to Jessica Chen Weiss from the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. She says there's a lot of room for reasonable debate about how to develop smarter U.S. policies on China.
The challenge is that when you take kind of a binary approach to either, you know, getting tough versus, you know, appearing weak, that really shrinks the space for discussion of how to pragmatically advance American interests in this, you know, really complex set of issues that implicate both the United States and China.
There are real challenges to American interests posed by China, like espionage and cyber attacks, Chen Weiss says. But lowering the temperature around the conversation about how to deal with China and advance U.S. interests would be a good place to start. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell. Iran's new president, Masoud Pezeshkian, addressed the United Nations General Assembly in New York yesterday. He accused Israel of barbarism and said it was trying to spark a wider regional war. Pezeshkian described Iranian proxy militias as freedom fighters, but he also had a more moderate message. Here he is speaking through an interpreter.
We are ready to engage with JCPOA participants if JCPOA commitments are implemented fully and in good faith. Dialogue on other issues can follow.
JCPOA is the acronym for the nuclear deal signed by Iran and several countries, including the U.S. in 2015, but the U.S. withdrew from the deal in 2018 under President Trump. This new message from Iran's president comes at a precarious moment for the Middle East, with Israel's war in Gaza still grinding on and fighting with Hezbollah in Lebanon heating up. Sanam Vakil is with the think tank Chatham House in London, where she directs the Middle East and North Africa program.
We have this reform-oriented president in Iran who has committed to trying to improve the Iranian economy since the U.S. withdrawal from the Iran Nuclear Agreement, or JCPOA, in 2018. Iran has been under a huge amount of U.S. sanctions. And in order to obtain sanctions relief and improve the economic conditions inside Iran, Pezeshkian is trying to open negotiations with European countries that have been a party to the deal, but also particularly with the United States. So this meeting in New York is an opportunity to show an olive branch and to have sidebar meetings that will set up discussions, hopefully after the U.S. election.
Well, the U.S. walked away from the nuclear deal under Donald Trump. Why would Iran want to resurrect that agreement now? What do you think that tells us more widely about the position Iran currently finds itself in?
Well, I don't think that Iran actually wants to resurrect the former agreement. In fact, the new foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, has sort of stated quite openly that the JCPOA doesn't really work. And it doesn't work for a few reasons. First of all, the U.S. withdrew, and that creates instability. But secondly, Russia and China are parties to the nuclear agreement. And so it's unlikely that in this climate of the war in Ukraine and tensions with China that they would get on board for a bigger agreement. So I think the Iranians want to use the framework of the JCPOA to try to negotiate something that might be sustainable and give Iran a bit of a lifeline economically.
We can't obviously ignore what's in the foreground. Iranian proxies are fighting Israel in Gaza and in Lebanon. How is this all connected to Pezeshkian's apparent willingness to get back to nuclear talks?
You know, obviously, Iran is the patron behind the axis of resistance groups that include Hezbollah, the Houthis in Yemen, Hamas, groups in Syria, as well as in Iraq. Iran has supported these groups, nurtured these groups, and they're united ideologically in opposing Israel and standing up to Israel. And this is part of Iran's sort of defense strategy to use these groups to protect Iran from attack from Israel. You know, if these negotiations bear fruit, I think there is an opportunity, and this is, you know, quite tricky to imagine, where Iran will also have to make some maybe concessions within the region, maybe commit to stop financially supporting these groups or transferring them missiles and drones to have a more sustainable nuclear agreement.
In terms of Iran's relationship with Hamas and Hezbollah, how much of that is managed by Iran's president, Masoud Pezeshkian?
Very little is managed by the executive branch. These are relationships, first of all, that have been cultivated over decades, and they're personal to a certain degree, mainly controlled and managed by Iran's IRGC and Quds Force, the extension of the IRGC in the region.
Well, experts seem to agree that Iran does not want to go to war directly with Israel. But can you see a situation where Iran would come more publicly to the aid of Hezbollah or Hamas to defend them against the Israelis?
Iran appears by many people as weak, and that by not responding or pushing back against Israel, it's inviting further attacks from Israel also on Hezbollah. There is certainly going to be mounting pressure within the Iranian landscape to respond, but I don't imagine that Iran is going to directly engage militarily. These groups are empowered. Hezbollah has been preparing for a confrontation with Israel since the last big one in 2006. Iran ultimately wants to come out of this with as much of the axis of resistance intact. It's aware that they're being degraded, but they need to survive this. And oftentimes in Middle Eastern wars, survival is a victory.
Sanam Vakil is the director of the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House.
A year ago, Azerbaijan launched a military operation that led to the displacement of more than 100,000 Armenians. They were living in the region of Nagorno-Karabakh, that is inside Azerbaijan, but historically mostly Armenians have lived there. Not anymore, though, after last year's military operation. Displaced Armenians are still processing the loss of their homes in Nagorno-Karabakh. But as the world's Daniel Offman reports from the Armenian capital of Yerevan, the biggest adjustment so far might actually be to the culture.
Anna Bagdasaryan was born and raised in Nagorno-Karabakh. She went to school there, attended music college, and became a piano teacher. I meet her at Nansen Park in the eastern part of Yerevan. She flips through her camera roll and shows me some shots from home.
Oh, this is me playing the piano. That's my room. That's how I left everything. And this one is us drinking coffee with the neighbors. We really got along.
She says life here isn't the same.
For a year, I've lived in an apartment building nearby, and none of the neighbors have knocked on my door. Back home, it was not like that.
Bagdasaryan says she teaches music in Yerevan, but she says she misses her former students. She shows me clips on Instagram of her playing piano back in Nagorno-Karabakh.
For the past year, I haven't played for fun. I can't. It's too painful. So I only play while I'm teaching students.
Bagdasaryan says people displaced from Nagorno-Karabakh face many challenges. One of the biggest ones is finding affordable housing in Yerevan. In the same park, I meet 84-year-old Alyusha Vashkanyan, who's also from Nagorno-Karabakh. I came here with nothing, Vashkanyan says. We barely got any help, and no one cares. For the first few months, Vashkanyan says, there were 13 of us living in a two-bedroom apartment. Vashkanyan blames the government for not doing enough to support people displaced from Nagorno-Karabakh. Siranush Shahakyan is a Yerevan-based international human rights lawyer who advocates for people displaced from Nagorno-Karabakh.
There is an issue of integration. They are ethnic Armenians, but they lived in different conditions. They have their own subculture, language, and so on.
The Armenian government does provide a housing stipend. They give about $130 per month per household member.
This is not sufficient. If we study Armenian rental market, then the prices would not reflect this amount offered by the government.
And that's especially the case in Yerevan, where the average rent for a one-bedroom apartment is about $800. The other major issue is employment. Sahakyan says that the job market in Yerevan is much more competitive than in Nagorno-Karabakh.
Not every Artsakh people was successful to have job placement, so it would require some time to train those people, to requalify them to meet the conditions of Armenian job market.
One organization that's helping women adjust to life in Yerevan is an NGO called the Women's Resource Center. Gayane Hambartsumyan is the president, originally from Nagorno-Karabakh.
Being displaced and being in a big city is a double challenge that the women we work with are dealing with.
Hambartsumyan says people have culture shock when they come to Yerevan, a city with a population of more than a million people.
We show people where metro stops are, really simple things like that. We go to the metro with them because some people are scared of the sound of the metro. They worry about missing their stop because they're not familiar with the city.
Hambartsumyan's NGO also provides psychological support for those still processing the trauma of displacement. Back at Nansen Park, Anna Bagdasaryan is scrolling through her camera roll and reminiscing.
Every
day I'm still at home in Nagorno-Karabakh. I'm there in my thoughts and in my dreams. And I still have hope that we'll return.
Lawyer Siranush Sahakyan says that Karabakh Armenians have the right to return to their homelands, but she says Azerbaijan continues to violate their property rights. So her law center is litigating an international court on behalf of Armenians who still hope to return to their property. However, even if her organization prevails, Sahakyan says it will take years before they're compensated, and even longer before Karabakh Armenians are given access to their homeland. For The World, I'm Daniel Hoffman, Yerevan, Armenia.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Poland started taking in war refugees from Ukraine back in 2014. That's when Russia first invaded Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula. An NGO based in the Polish capital, the Uniters Foundation, has been helping Ukrainian refugees with food and other assistance for the past decade. This year, the organization created a new and very different way to show support for Ukraine. Reporter Jamie Fullerton paid a visit to the Uniters Foundation in Warsaw.
Did they mention I was coming down today?
Yes, they told me about this, so I would love to show you around.
In an office building in central Warsaw, I meet Olia Bosova. The lobby has the mildly musty scent of a second-hand clothes store. A few women are perusing T-shirts hanging on racks, while others are being handed packs of diapers. Ukraine's blue and yellow national flag is taped to the door.
So anyone can come here and take something for themselves, whatever they need. So here
this is the Warsaw headquarters of Uniters Foundation. It's an NGO that helps Ukrainian refugees, and it's run mainly by Ukrainian volunteers, like Bosova. Many volunteers are refugees themselves.
What we do here, as you can see, is quite a large operation with helping the refugees.
Uniters Foundation was founded in 2014 when Russia invaded Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula. Since Russia invaded Ukraine in 2022, the NGO has gone into overdrive. Ukraine borders Poland, and there are now around 1 million Ukrainian refugees in Poland, primarily women and children. In Warsaw, Uniters gives away clothes, food and other supplies to refugees. Each day, up to 500 refugees visit the centre.
Let's keep going.
Uniters has around 200 volunteers in Warsaw. They also send supplies to Ukrainian troops fighting the Russians.
So what I also wanted to show you is the camouflage nets that we make. Also, all
in one room, four women are cutting up bed sheets donated by hotels. The sheets are dyed green or brown, then attached to nets to create camouflage shrouds for Ukrainian soldiers' vehicles.
As you can see, this lady is very skilled. She's doing it very fast.
Another room contains surgery bags stuffed with tourniquets, swabs and syringes.
Also for stuffing the wound
But earlier this year, UNITAS launched an entirely different project to help Ukraine's war effort, a project that's rather more aggressive than handing out cardigans and bread.
Now we're going to go see the drones, I think.
Right.
Drones. In one small room, two UNITAS volunteers are fiddling with screwdrivers, laptops and various mechanical parts. They're assembling and programming drones to send to Ukraine's front lines.
This is a kamikaze drone. Yes, it's a kamikaze drone. It's a one-time use only drone, so it carries like a small explosive. And it goes straight to the enemy.
The volunteers show me a video of a drone flying over a field. The black drones are about a foot wide and are equipped with cameras and night vision. Ukrainian troops use them for surveillance near front lines, delivering medical supplies and for guiding Russian soldiers who want to surrender.
So what would you actually put on there? Would it be like a small bomb or something?
A small bomb, yeah.
Some of the drones can carry a grenade or an anti-tank mine, and some can travel up to 10 kilometres. Since March this year, UNITAS volunteers have made around 250 drones, importing parts from Asia to keep costs low. The NGO is funded by donations. If you fund a drone for around $500, you can write a message that will be attached to it. Bosova picks up a drone and reads the note on it.
It says, "Glory to Ukraine, glory to the heroes." It's vulgar.
Many countries, including the US and Canada, give Ukraine weapons, supplies or money to help the country defend itself against the ongoing Russian invasion. Also, in 2024, the Ukraine government is planning to domestically produce a total of 1 million FPV drones. That's drones with first-person view cameras. So, why does an NGO have to supply drones to Ukraine? Bosova introduces me to Halina Andrushki, who founded UNITAS. Andrushki says Ukraine needs as many drones as possible and that UNITAS drones have a reputation for high quality. Being an NGO, UNITAS can often deliver supplies quicker than foreign governments may be able to, because UNITAS can bypass some government bureaucracy. UNITAS volunteers drive minivans in and out of Ukraine and communicate directly with Ukrainian troops on the front lines. If a unit requests a UNITAS drone, they can often get one delivered within a day. This system became more efficient this summer after Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky visited Warsaw. Andrushki briefly met him and asked him to quicken the border crossing processes for volunteers taking drones into Ukraine. Shortly afterwards, UNITAS volunteers found that they didn't have any more hold-ups when taking drones across the border.
Go straight to the top.
Talk to the president.
Yeah, easy, right? Easy.
Andrushki says she launched the drone project partly because her brother, who was fighting in Ukraine, was killed in 2023 amid a Russian drone attack. She says Russia's invasion of Ukraine brought Ukrainian civil society to life, and that this movement to help Ukraine can't be stopped. As we talk, a van arrives at UNITAS HQ, delivering huge tins of beans for the refugees. The volunteers form a human chain, passing the heavy bean cans into the building and onto shelves. Before I leave, Bosova introduces me to Tatiana Polaretz. She's a refugee from Ukraine and is helping make the camouflage nets.
We're doing the nets because we want to go home sooner.
Yeah, I wish.
Психологічна потреба робити хоч щось для того, щоб це швидше закінчилось.
We have a very large need, psychological need, to do anything we can so that all of this ends sooner.
Polaret's fellow volunteers nod in agreement, and I leave them to their sheet cutting. For the world, I'm Jamie Fullerton in Warsaw.
Join us tomorrow on The World for a culinary trip across Africa, from grilled meats to aromatic curries. Cookbook author Alexander Small shares recipes from his new book, The Contemporary African Kitchen. That is tomorrow on the show.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Join us right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the Ford Foundation. By the Henry Luce Foundation. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Patchwork Collective, Lillianne and Ed Schneider, the Gruber Family Foundation, Catherine Harris and Tom Kaiser, and Helen and Russell Pine. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.